WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everybody. Now the editor of The New Yorker, David Remnick. He has a 17,000-word megastory this week about what's left of the Obama presidency. He got to spend a fair amount of time with the president for this and has previously written a book about him. So David Remnick is one of the very knowledgeable people about President Obama. Also, big news, David Remnick, who is also a Russia expert, will be doing commentaries from the Sochi Olympics for NBC next month, part of their coverage of the Games. So we'll talk about that. And listeners will open up the phones for your questions on these topics or all things New Yorker. Ask David Remnick at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. David, thanks for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
My pleasure, Brian.
The headline of your piece, at least the headline on the cover of the magazine, is three more years. Is the suggestion that the president already is a lame duck?
Well, you know, by the standards of Beltway Washington, in a year he will be. You know, William Daley, who was the chief of staff for Obama, once told Ryan Lizard that after 2014, nobody cares what Barack Obama does, which is, that's what they say in Washington. Once the second-term president passes the midterm elections, that everything closes down politically. The media air goes all to the successor race, to Hillary Clinton or to Rubio or whoever it might be. On the other hand, there's always on the other hand.
Especially
God
with Barack
knows what
Obama.
Can happen. Well, exactly. That's his style of discussion.
Which is one of the big points of your article.
But, you know, things can happen in the world, and you have a sitting president, and no candidate can deal with those. So I think that it's not unlikely that the president gave me that kind of access because he wanted to insist on his capacities to do what he can do in the next 3 years.
And you wrote that you wanted to hear Obama work through his thinking. And one of the obvious themes is that he's always willing to talk through both sides of the argument on the one hand. On the other hand, you have him doing it with Democratic overreach about crime and police abuse. You have him doing it with Keystone on both sides of the Keystone pipeline, much to the chagrin, I'm sure, of environmentalists. We actually did a little math on your piece. And here's what we counted. Twice he says on the other hand, twice he says on the flip side. There's two, but I also think one, having said that, going to the other side, and one, let's not dismiss out of hand the other side of the argument.
Brian, on the other hand,
yes,
we had a president prior to Barack Obama whose style of thought was quite the opposite. With us or against us, I insist, my mind cannot be changed. A very different style of thinking. A certain degree of complexity is a good thing in thinking of a president.
Of course. So how much is his willingness to entertain both sides a strength, now that you've covered Obama so closely for all these years, and how much do you think it's a political weakness?
Well, of all the issues you mentioned, the only one where he hasn't made a decision and it's not clear where he's going to land is the Keystone Pipeline. So in each case, there's no question what policy is or where he has moved to. So I think this is a style of mind rather than a question of an indecisive president. In fact, Obama, as even Robert Gates tells us in his memoir, is quite decisive, and somebody who's comfortable with making decisions. It's just that he has a very deliberative style of getting there. And again, this is not a piece about condemning or endorsing, but I would have thought, and I still think, that that is something that we saw in Abraham Lincoln and some of our very best presidents, is a comfort with the very real complexity that they face, whether it's about what to do about something as horrible as Syria or income inequality or any number of issues.
Did you go in with a thesis about Obama at this moment? And after 17,000 words, do you come out with a thesis that was proven or disproven or partially proven?
No, I think that's for op-ed columns. I mean, I think that the reason for length here was the rare ability to hear Obama talking through his work following a horrendous political year. I mean, the distinguishing thing about this is that it comes at the end of a really bad political year, and the final event was the most devastating because it was self-inflicted, and that's the really botched rollout of a policy that still has the capacity to do great things for our society, which is Obamacare. For all its drawbacks, it may not be what we wanted it to be or what I might like it to be, like single payer, but it is ambitious social policy, and the rollout was an unmitigated disaster.
There's a section of your piece on this pretty well-known idea that Obama doesn't like to schmooze. He's a reluctant fundraiser, and he doesn't go to parties or have people over for drinks as much as other politicians. And, of course, a lot of Obama supporters dismiss this argument as superficial and point out that it's not like John Boehner would accept an invitation to go bowling or whatever anyway. Did you come down on one side of the argument about how important these little social interactions are to his effectiveness, or learn anything new about it?
I think they're only important on the margins. I think there I'd have to agree with him. The notion that LBJ got through the social programs that he did between 1964 and 1966 based on an ability to pour a good bourbon in branch water is childish. It's fantasy. The reason he got that through was because he had gigantic majorities in the House of Representatives and the Senate. And following the assassination of an extremely popular president, and he employed those advantages the best he could to get through the voting rights and civil rights and Medicare. Was he good in the old-fashioned way of retail politics? You bet he was. But to say it saved him from all political mistakes is just an ignorance of history. Look at Vietnam.
In fact, this came up earlier on the show in another context, that LBJ, in trying to get the Civil Rights Act passed in 1964, did all kinds of things to woo and to press legislators from the West who were seen as, you know, kind of potentially swayable, largely because they didn't have many black constituents in their states. He didn't even try with the people in the South, the congressmen from the South, because he considered them a lost cause. Unfortunately for Obama, almost the entire House of Representatives has been a lost cause from day one.
You're exactly right, and I think just the nature of politics has changed too. You also had a kind of party discipline in those days that's very different from now. Everybody's an individual actor. I'm not saying we should have nostalgia for the Congress of racist Democrats from the South, certainly not. But it was a very different map that LBJ was facing, almost a different sociology of politics and Congress that Obama does now. You have in the House, but also in the Senate, a radicalized right-wing Republican Party that just did not exist in the same way in the mid-60s. Look at, you know, New York had Jacob Javits, who was a liberal by any stretch, by today's standards, in the Republican Party. Such creatures do not walk the earth any longer.
Listeners, David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker, with us. We can take your phone calls for him. Maybe you read his Obama article in this week's edition. We're going to get into his coming role for NBC at the Sochi Olympics and some of the things that he's already written about Putin and the gay rights issue over there surrounding the Olympics and other things. New Yorker, 212-433-WNYC if you want to call in, 433-9692, or post a question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. One other thing about Obama, and then I want to go on to Sochi, but you know, then we might circle back to your presidential stuff. In your 2010 book on Obama called The Bridge, you described him as a shapeshifter, someone who could change styles without relinquishing his genuineness, I guess like when he spoke to white or black audiences. Do you want to revise that impression of Obama with all the problems he's had reaching beyond his base?
No, I think he won the presidency twice, so we shouldn't diminish his skills as a politician. It's hilarious for me to hear people say, oh, he's a terrible politician, he's a reluctant politician. Here's a guy who won the presidency twice as a black man with a name that practically does rhyme with the most notorious terrorists of our generation. You can't be a terrible politician and do that. What I was trying to get at in the book is that when he speaks to different audiences, very often the tone will change enough to meet people at least halfway. This is not unique to a black man running for president. This, you know, there are people that do this when they talk to their parents who live in another country. Their accent suddenly changes. It's a very natural thing. It's a human thing. He's just quite good at it. And yet it doesn't come off as phony. I think there's a political skill. That's not going to work when you talk to John Boehner or Mitch McConnell. What works there, and what works in foreign affairs as well, is an argument over, a debate over, a meeting over interests. Interests, political interests, not charm.
But you concluded in this kind of jumped out at me from the article that Obama's style, his strengths, in a sense, are not well matched to the political moment in Washington, right?
Well, I remember some of the reaction to the piece, Brian, is that somehow he seemed withdrawn or depressed or something like that. I don't buy that. I wasn't trying to say that at all. What I just about his mood and his way of speaking, this is him talking to a print reporter with a lot of time. If he's going to talk to someone on television and they know it's a 5-minute interview, he is going to present himself a little differently. Mm-hmm. He's going to speak more quickly. He's going to be very aware of his, you know, performative aspects. When it's for print, it's almost as if he's writing his answers. He slows himself down. He takes his time. He makes sure that every sentence begins to form a perfectly formed paragraph. That was what I was trying mm-hmm. to point out, not somehow that he is speaking so slowly that he seems glum or depressed. Mm-hmm. And I've heard all this right. from Wolf Blitzer and Chuck Todd, and I think they've got it wrong.
All right. New topic. You're going into television, doing guest commentary for NBC at the Olympics next month.
I'm not doing speed skating, I promise
you. You're not going to do 17,000-word discourses on Putin in the middle of the Olympic ceremony when they give you 3 minutes or whatever they give you. Obviously, you're very knowledgeable about Russia. And
well,
like,
the medium is the medium.
And, right. And, so what's your role going to be?
My role is to have things to say about Russia as it's happening now. I mean, if there's no question that the opening ceremonies are many things. They're a celebration of the athletes, they're a celebration of the Olympic spirit and all that stuff, and there are plenty of people to say things about that. But it's also a self-presentation of Russia today. Russia is a place that is now going to be on the international stage in a very, very vivid way. How do they want to present themselves? How does it match up with reality? Who is Vladimir Putin? All those questions are things that I think I can talk about. Maybe it won't be 17,000 words, but on the other hand, this is probably a gigantic audience, and not everybody in that audience is necessarily paying attention to Russia in a political way. So, in a more concise fashion, I'll try to have things to say about whether it's the gay propaganda law, this really scandalous gay propaganda law, or who Putin is and what he's trying to do. I think it's it'll be an interesting attempt.
Yeah, and I'm glad that they hired you to do it, and that we're going to get that kind of context from somebody like you, and from you in particular. Let me give listeners a one sentence taste of your take on Putin in the scathing New Yorker piece from last month about Putin and the so-called gay propaganda law in Russia. One thing you wrote: the leadership invokes an anti-gay rhetoric reminiscent of the way Soviet leaders used to denounce Jews as internal enemies, the agents of foreign capital and spy services. Can you elaborate on that, gays as the new Soviet Jewry?
Well, I think they're an easy other. You know, in an attempt to unify the population, that there's they're trying to unify a population in terms of its resentments rather than its commonalities. And quite frankly, somebody like Putin has available to him state television, which is the main purveyor of information, and state television takes its cues from Putin. So you turn on state television now, and you have commentators and sometimes leaders of the Russian Orthodox Church and elsewhere saying horrifying things about gay men and lesbians, and it's quite alarming. And you can't tell me that the uptick in hate crimes against homosexuals in Russia is not influenced by this.
It's like he's giving them permission. In fact, I'll read a longer passage from your piece that was striking to me. You wrote, "Lest anyone think that Putin is not controlling the expressions of homophobia in the official Russian media, he just appointed Dmitry Kiselyov, a former television anchor, head of the new state news agency. In April 2012, Kiselyov went on Rossiya and said to a rapt Rossiya One, that's a TV station?
TV station, yeah.
And said to a rapt studio audience, quote, 'I think that to fine gays for propagandizing homosexuality among teenagers is not enough. They should be prohibited from donating blood or sperm, and their hearts, in the case of a car accident, should be buried or burned as unfit for extending anyone's life.' And then you add, the applause that followed was as startling as the statement itself." Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, oh, my goodness is right. This is not some marginal nutcase, which would be bad enough. It is a person of enormous responsibility in Russian media, official Russian media, and is there by appointment of the highest level in Russia. It's very alarming.
Before we take a break and then go to the phones, I heard a discussion on a conservative talk station recently about how the politics of U.S.-Russia relations are beginning to shift over this gay issue. It used to be conservatives who denounced Putin for being anti-U.S., and liberals said, well, we need to do business with our enemies and not get sucked into another Cold War.
Now, totally false.
Now I'll lay out the rest of this, I think, Pat Buchanan argument. Now, because of the gay rights issue, liberals want to cut off Russia, and some conservatives are seeing Putin, especially social conservatives, seeing Putin as the last defender of old-fashioned Western morality of all things. You see any of that shift going on?
That is a comical analysis. Who was the initiator of what we now remember as détente during the Cold War? That would be the great liberal Richard Nixon, who was the inventor of human rights as a key component of Cold War political battle. That would be the great right-winger Jimmy Carter. It just makes no sense. Cold War was extremely complex. And
This was all in the Putin context. It may not make any sense anyway, but this was all about how people feel about Russia today.
Let's not be hypocritical either. We've had gay marriage in this country for about 5 minutes.
Right.
Homophobia has not disappeared from the face of the United States entirely.
Right.
And what makes Putin crazy and where he attacks back so vociferously is what he sees as Western hypocrisy. In his point of view, and keep in mind what I'm about to say is his point of view, is that Russia, came into being, as the state it is, only 20 years ago, 1991. The Soviet Union collapsed, which he sees as a geopolitical and human tragedy. Communism collapsed, which he sees less as a tragedy. And the state has since been trying to rebuild itself. Its great success, in his view, has been its kind of Saudi Arabian economic miracle, which is the kind of huge resource economy that's enriched the very top of Russian society, oil and gas. But still, the country is still reeling from 1,000 years of autocracy and 70-odd years of communism. And for us, and he finds it maddening when we lecture him on things that we just came to an accommodation about 15 minutes ago.
Listener Dora tweets, will Remnick visit neighboring country Ukraine as part of his trip to the Olympics?
Not this time around. Not this time around, although this is part of what I'm talking about. The Ukraine is literally split in half, in psychologically, economically, politically, in its desire to reach toward the West and its traditional relations with Russia. And
is that what we're seeing in this crisis in the streets with these demonstrations, and now there's
very definitely
police firing on the demonstrators in Kiev?
Very definitely. I mean, what's behind all this, the political struggle going on here is, and what's tearing Ukraine up is this, these differing impulses toward the West and toward Russia. And Russia has enormous desire to keep Ukraine within its sphere of influence. Eastern Ukraine is made up largely of Russian-speaking people who want to stay in that realm. People in the West see themselves as leaning toward Poland and then farther toward Western Europe, and that's the inner division of Ukraine, which, by the way, is an enormous country. I think it's the second most populous country in Europe, Coverage of what's going on in Ukraine is, with the exception of the New York Times and very few other places, quite scant.
Yes. All right, listeners, we're going to take a break, and then we'll come back with your phone calls. And I'll also read tweets if you want to tweet us at Brian Lehrer or post on our comments page, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, 212-433-WNYC for the New Yorker editor, David Remnick, on Obama. He's got that long cover story this week. On Russia, he's a longtime expert, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, going to be covering the Sochi Olympics for NBC News on the issue side while they do, of course, the sports coverage of the games. 212-433-9692. Or what do you want to ask him about? The New Yorker. I'm going to ask him a thing or two when we come back, but it's mostly for you for the rest of the segment. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, and stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker, and Nicole in Stamford. You're on WNYC. Hello, Nicole.
Hi. I actually don't have a question. I just wanted to thank Mr. Remnick. I think he edits the best magazine in America, and I finally entered the demographic that your magazine is targeted to. I was given it way too young before I could ever understand any of the articles by my dad, who lives in Seattle and is probably one of your oldest subscribers. He is still an avid reader at 94. He had pony editions of the New Yorker dropped in Australia
during the war.
When he worked on during World War II, when he worked on MacArthur's staff at General Headquarters. So he introduced his kids to that magazine, you know, when we were way, way too young. Now I'm in my 50s, and I can't wait to introduce it to my kids, but they're only 12 and 14, so they're a little young.
Well, don't wait too long. I started reading it, admittedly started with the cartoons when I was a kid sneaking down into my father's office where he had endless amounts of magazines. I'm delighted that you like the magazine. I'm really privileged.
Thank you. Please keep up the great work. It's a wonderful
thank
magazine.
Thank you.
Isn't that nice? How often does anybody walk down the street and get thanked for their work, right?
It's fantastic. That's perfect.
I appreciate it. Did you understand the cartoons when you were 12 and 13?
You know, I'm going to tell you a little secret on the radio. once in a while we'll have a feature in the magazine called I Don't Get It. And we'll have four or five or six cartoons that even we don't get anymore. And I forget why I bought it in the first place, but not too often.
That's hysterical, and I'm glad you shared the secret.
I don't think a day passes, Brian, where somebody doesn't come up to me and said, has something like that to say about one cartoon or another, and I promise we don't do it deliberately.
And I promise I won't tell anybody. Tom in Astoria. Tom, you're on WNYC with David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker. Hi.
Well, hi. After following that call, I feel kind of petty because I have some small suggestions for the magazine. But
fair enough.
I too think it's wonderful, and my mother is 84 up in Buffalo, and she still gets it every week.
That's great to hear.
Thank you. But I'm an artist, and one of the things I turn to in The New Yorker for is the arts coverage. Mm-hmm. And the way you've changed the goings-on around town page, mm-hmm. I used to depend on that for sort of an encyclopedic look of what's going on now in the art world. Mm-hmm. And I kind of miss it, and I wondered if you've had any response to how you've changed that page. And also I find Calvin Tompkins at 88 and Peter Sedgell at 71, I feel like you could use some fresh blood in the art criticism department.
Well, I think one thing I should say about goings-on about town is that it's never been encyclopedic, that New York, much less the whole country, is so variegated when it comes to the arts that we were never in the business of giving you everything. We can't be Time Out New York, and I think increasingly the way people go to get the everythingness of New York as they go online. And I think that we had to respond to that. We couldn't keep up the fiction that somehow we were giving you complete listings of galleries or movies or really about anything. What we had to do is more concentrate on the curatorial aspect. In other words, what we like, what we think is good on a given week, and go from there. And concede that, for reasons of space, really, concede that people are going to go to the web to get the allness of any given city that they're reading The New Yorker in. And as far as the art coverage is, you know, that's just a matter of taste. I mean, Peter Sheldahl, to me, is the best art critic out there, and his capacity to fall in love with new and wonderful things seems to me undiminished, but again, it's not a battle to have. It's just a discussion and a disagreement when you and I might have.
And Tom, thank you for your call. And here's a piece of New Yorker ephemera. We had a caller who couldn't wait, who wanted to know why your name never appears as editor in The New Yorker. And he's right. You don't have a masthead like many publications do, right?
No, thank God. It saves us a lot of it saves us a lot of mishigas, I would think. You know, who's over who and who's to the side of whom. We could live without that. And I'm not wanting for people know who the editor is, who care to know, and it's I would rather spend that space rather than having a masthead on another piece, another Talk of the Town piece, more coverage of the arts, as the last gentleman suggested.
Andrew in Little Italy, you're on WNYC with David Remnick. Hi, Andrew. Andrew,
hi
there.
How are you, Brian?
Hi, good.
I'm actually with Queer Nation, which is the gay rights group that's been spearheading, at least in the United States or in New York, the protests against Putin's anti-gay laws in Russia. And what mm-hmm. I'm curious about is, given that NBC is sending you over and mm-hmm. also the broadcaster and sponsor of the Olympics, what kind of reporting you're planning to do from Sochi, and whether NBC has asked you not to do certain kinds of reporting, and if that's the case, what it's been. Because NBC has done next to no reporting from Russia about the situation there, and has certainly not spoken to any gay lesbian Russians.
Well, the piece that Brian was reading from before had to do with my own reporting with precisely that, with speaking to gay and lesbian representatives from Russia. And I've written extensively about extensively about Russia for years and years. I lived there for 4 years and wrote about gays and lesbian in Russia in 1988.
Right. Well, that's 1988. If I can finish
my answer, and this was a few weeks ago, and my obligations to NBC are strictly with the opening ceremonies, and I will have things to say about exactly what you're talking about on the air. And absolutely no one said to me, you can't say this, that, or the other thing. I wouldn't agree to that. I would never do it. And I will also write for The New Yorker from there and have every intention of covering things as I report them and see them.
Are you only going to be on the opening ceremonies?
I think here and there, if they ask me to go on and do a 2 or 3 minute bit on one show or another, possibly. But it's mainly opening ceremonies. And God knows I'm not there to cover, cross-country skiing for them, or I don't know, a triple axel from a double south show. It's just not my – I was a sports reporter in my long-ago youth for the Washington Post for a couple of years, but curling was not my beat.
That's funny. Well, I've seen it suggested that your presence gives their main personalities the space not to deal with it. For example, Bob Costas, who often speaks his mind on issues in the context of his sports commentary, told the AP the other day that he won't comment on the gay propaganda law because he's trying to land an interview with, quote, responsible people, unquote, in Russia, which has been taken by some to mean Putin himself. So do you think that they're using you in any way to take the heat off the sports guys so they can just focus on the games and ignore the issues the rest of the time?
Well, it's a tough thing for them because sports guys are used to sports, and news people are used to a whole range of other subjects. So I think by having me there, even though it's a sporting event, I can talk. First of all, I can talk with some knowledge about this. I mean, Bob Costas is a smart guy, and he reads the paper, but I don't think he spends most of his time or any huge part of his time reporting on these subjects. I'm not anybody's cover. I'm there to speak frankly and openly and with my eyes open. Otherwise, why do it? Now, that's not to say somebody's giving me an hour to go on and on and on. There's limits to it, and without question. But I also have another platform, which I was intending to use all along, which was to write at some length about these games for The New Yorker magazine, which is may not have quite the scale of the audience of the of NBC Sports on a given night, but we give it a shot.
Let me just let our caller finish a thought. Andrew, briefly,
sure.
Was there something else you wanted to say?
Well, the two things that I'd like to say, first of all, is that we're looking forward to David's reporting from Sochi after he's spoken to the gay and lesbian Russians there and about how the laws were affecting them. But I'd also point out that The New Yorker isn't NBC. My point is that NBC has really shied away from the issue, and I think with pretty obvious reasons. And I am hoping that, like you said, Brian, that David is not being hired as a cover so that they can point to him as what they're doing, much in the same way as frankly, that they used Thomas Roberts. They've been making a show of being interested in the situation on the ground in Russia, but there's been very little follow through, and it's been pretty good pink wash and PR for them.
So we're all going to watch for how much actually comes through there. David,
I hear you loud and clear, and I take what you say very, very seriously. And I intend to, again, I don't want to, at the cost of repeating myself, I intend to talk very clearly about this.
Andrew, thank you. And call us when the games are on and give us your review. David on Twitter tweets, I wish... No, that's the wrong one. Sorry. Aaron on Twitter says, please ask him why Obama hasn't had public roundtable discussions with the GOP like he did early on regarding health care.
I don't know the answer to that question. I know you're never supposed to say that on TV or radio. I don't know the answer to that question. I just don't know. And I think that's a question that's well directed to the administration in some way or another. I don't know.
Maybe because it was a disaster.
Yeah, there's that.
When he did that. I mean, he looked,
yeah, it
like...
It was like making the sausage in public and then,
yeah,
coming up with a mess.
I watched some of that, and he did not look like he was really listening to them. They looked like they were just firing spitballs at him. I don't know that it accomplished anything because it was just, yeah, you know, mutual hostility theater.
I think that makes good sense.
In your piece, you're backstage with Obama at a speech, and you write this. Obama walked toward the stage, and as he was announced, he mouthed the words, "Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States." Really? He mouthed the words?
He kind of, yeah. Yeah, he was kidding around.
So he's the teleprompter president, really? No, he was just playing.
There was somebody announcing him, and he did it at the same time, just to kind of fool around as he was walking. He was still in the wings when he did it.
And the final quote in your piece, he says, "I just wanted to add one thing to that business about the great man theory of history. The president of the United States cannot remake our society, and that's probably a good thing." And then he adds, "Not probably, it's definitely a good thing." Were you surprised by that?
No, not at all. I think it's his way of saying, look, a president can do a lot, can do an enormous amount. Can, you know, and look at Franklin Roosevelt or Lincoln or all the transformative presidents we've experienced. And I'm not sure that Obama's in anywhere near that category, certainly not yet.
But he had come in saying he wanted to be transformative in 2008,
but remaking,
right,
a society is something else that only dictators get to do. There's a difference. There's a big difference. That the New Deal does not happen just because of a president. There needs to be a Congress in concert with that president. The same thing has to do with the great social legislation between 1964 and 66. You have to have a federal government that's working with some degree of cooperation. What we have now in Washington is a complete logjam to the detriment of
the country,
of people.
Claire in Manhattan. You're on WNYC with David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker. Hi, Claire.
Hi. Just want to say I love this program, and I would be devastated if I ever lost The New Yorker.
I promise you we're doing fine.
Yes, I know.
I'd be pretty devastated, too. So just,
yeah, right.
We have a common interest.
Okay. My question is, I follow the stories very closely, and I'm struck by how dark they are.
Are you talking about the fiction, Claire?
Yes.
The short stories?
Right.
Okay.
And I'm distressed by how dark they are. It seems to be a pattern now, or a consistent one. And I wondered if there was some thinking about that, or whether that's just in the general zeitgeist.
Well, I think it's probably the latter. Remember, fiction is what comes to us. Journalism can be assigned, and you can point a reporter in a comic direction, but the fiction comes to us. We're certainly selecting things,
mm-hmm,
but we also look for comic writers. We look for, you know, somebody like George Saunders, who's gotten a lot of attention in the last couple of years, is a very, very funny writer. Not funny, you know, Lena Dunham funny, but funny and maybe even darkly funny. In the old days, Donald Barthelme was darkly funny. And a lot of people that we consider serious have very comic sides. In fact, if you talk to Russians, they think Dostoevsky is hilarious. So it's not funny in the same way that Shouts and Murmurs is funny, but there are comic aspects to these stories, and we really do make an effort, maybe not every week, to look for that, but life is filled with agony and trials and darkness and all the rest too, and that's reflected in the fiction.
Well, I don't know if you have a take on this as somebody who came out of journalism to become the editor of The New Yorker, but I think literature today, fiction today in general, is much darker than it used to be. If you look at, for example, you know, the best short stories of the year, those books that are released in the holiday season every year, dark story after dark story. I think fiction has become more dark, and it's probably a reflection of our times.
I don't know. Compared to when, I bet you if you yanked out the best short stories of the 50s, you would find some pretty damn dark stories too. I mean, Salinger's A Perfect Day for Banana Fish is not stand-up comedy either. Fiction is going into the interior parts of our lives very, very often, and life is extraordinarily difficult and shadowed by death, and marriages are hard, and illnesses, and all the things that we face day to day, and to skip over that in any age would be an abdication.
Of course, and not to skip over it. But maybe I should go back and look at some lists of fiction bestsellers in the 50s and 60s and see if my impression stands up. I know that we have had this discussion on the show, and I've had it in my personal life as, you know, raising two kids in the city, that young adult fiction is surprisingly dark, and it's a topic of conversation among parents and teachers.
Right, young adult fiction, you see that this is of issue fiction. In other words, there's an issue that needs to be covered, and it wants to be instructive in moral ways and about the various difficulties of life. I think they're. But again, I don't have a scoreboard for any of this, dark versus light. But
and I guess if we want to point at the Hunger Games or something as dystopian, well, when we grew up, we were reading The Lord of the Flies. So
yeah. So, both hilarious.
So right, exactly. Let's see. We're almost out of time, so we're going to take a call about cartoons. John in Paramus, hi, you're on the air.
How you doing? I'm a long-time subscriber, and it's a great magazine, and it's a great article on Obama. I want to know two quick things. How good of a golfer is Obama, and how come my submissions for cartoons never get picked?
Well, I think Obama shoots for being one stroke over par on each hole. That's about as much golf information as I've got. And the question you just asked, why are your cartoon suggestions never picked for, I assume, the back page for
the cartoon feature.
I will tell you that I was once at a reception, and the former mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, came up to me, or I came up to him, we were talking, and he said, you know, I've been sending in these captions for months, and I never win. And all I could say is, you know, you're the richest guy in New York, and you're the mayor of New York. That's not enough. On the other hand, from somebody from Paramus, I'll do my best. I grew up two towns away from you, so I'll put a little thumb on the scale.
Or I'll recommend better cartoons, John. That's my key.
There we go.
Ted on our comments page writes, the best recent change in the magazine is that the mailing label can now be peeled off without marring the cover. Did you select the glue as editor-in-chief?
I stand to serve.
Isn't it amazing what people will write about?
I was on a street fair near my apartment. It was on Broadway one day, and there's one of those street fairs, and this guy sells New Yorker covers from all ages and vintage New Yorker covers, and I said, how come there are no covers from X year to X year? And he said, because of the damn mailing label. It mars the cover. And we found a way to get a kind of glue that allows you to peel it off the way you would with rubber cement without spending too much money. And I ran into him a couple of weeks later. He seemed extremely happy. So we try to please.
There you go. A piece of intelligence about the New Yorker. I never expected to hear. I never thought about the question. And there we will leave it with David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker. His 17,000-word piece on President Obama is the cover story this week. 3 more years, and he will be in Sochi at least for the opening ceremonies for NBC. I recommend you to his scathing article about Putin and the gay rights crackdown in Russia in The New Yorker a few weeks ago, which you can find online. David, thank you for giving us so much time. This has been really enjoyable and interesting.
My pleasure, Brian. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you so much. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.